Hello and welcome to Newspeak, our weekly look at the news agenda. I'm joined, I'm pleased to say, as usual, by Rafe Haider-Mancou, our senior fellow and royal historian, and Amy Gallagher, who is the SDP's candidate for the London mayoralty, and indeed the woman behind Stand Up To Woke. Now, before we actually go any further, a few notices here about our forthcoming locals events. There's so many of these happening now that I'm finding it quite difficult to keep track myself. But anyway, the first two are this coming Tuesday, are they not, Rafe? 23rd of April.
That's right. So St. George's Day, you can celebrate with kindred spirits in Bath and in Newcastle. So if you're in Bath or Newcastle, it's the 23rd of April. And then on the 28th of April, the New Culture Forum local branches will be launching, will be having events in Nottingham and in Norwich. And if you're in Norwich, you'll get to hear from Alka Segal Cuthbert, the head of Don't Divide Us. And if you are in Nottingham, you'll hear from Dr. Catherine McBride, who's a well-known pro-Brexit economist, frequently appears on GB News. And if you want to get information about either of those events in on the 23rd, Bath and Newcastle, 28th, Nottingham and Norwich, just email locals@newcultureforum.org.uk. That's locals@newcultureforum.org.uk.
Beautifully done, Rafe. Thank you so much. Also, just to add that it's entirely free, and these events, of course, are in the evening. So maybe you'll make it to one of those four. I hope so. Well, this week, I want to start with something which was a sort of completely unforeseen event. You know, it wasn't in the, you know, in the agenda or on the horizon or whatever. And that is that there was this NatCon conference, which was in Brussels, wasn't it? NatCon stands for National Conservatism, by the way. They have these events, they have these conferences every year. I spoke at one last year, for example, in London, around about this time. And basically, they tried to cancel it, didn't they?
Yeah, so this is an event that's put on by the Edmund Burke Foundation. And as you say, last year it was held in London, went pretty smoothly, pretty kind of mainstream speakers, Conservative MPs and people that viewers will probably heard of, James Orr, Matt Goodwin, who are kind of professors. Like I said, pretty mainstream. And this year it was held in Brussels, in Belgium. And straight away they had problems with essentially cancellation, in that the conference that they initially booked, the mayor of Brussels intervened and said it should be shut down because of the views that would be expressed. There was something in the press about kind of traditional conservative views on abortion and marriage being the reason for shutting it down. Mm-hmm. So they moved to a different conference event in a different location, and the local mayor in that area also shut it down and intervened and told the event to stop it from happening. They moved to a third location, at a third conference hall, and the mayor of that area also intervened and essentially threatened the owner of the conference hall, and threatened his wife, and threatened some of the staff who would be serving food there, that essentially that this needed to be shut down. At that point, all the police turned up, so the police were called and intervened in a speech that Nigel Farage was giving, and essentially barricaded the doors. That meant essentially if anybody left the conference, they wouldn't be able to return. This was all done in the name of protecting safety, or protecting kind of violence or protest. There actually wasn't much protest in any of the conferences.
Nothing.
So it was the anticipation of a potential violent protest. And of course, if that were to happen, which it didn't, then the police, the job of the police would be to police the protest and protect the freedom of speech of the people in the conference, because of course nobody in the conference was doing anything violent or untoward. They were just talking about traditional conservative values. It was only because at this third conference, lawyers essentially intervened and contacted government officials in Belgium and they said, look, this is a complete infringement of freedom of speech. Which it was, and then they eventually backed down and said, yes, you do have the right to freedom of assembly, which is kind of obvious. But if you think about it, the fact that so much effort was had to go into changing to three different locations, and of course, you know, the fact that it was held by quite well-known figures like Nigel Farage and Suella Braverman, who were both there, and of course people who had, you know, access to lawyers, only meant that this was able to go ahead. But if they hadn't, it may well have been shut down completely. It was absolutely absurd. Some of the police that turned up were wearing riot gear. There wasn't even a riot. So this was just, I mean, and obviously this is happening in the country which is the home of the European Union. So obviously Nigel Farage has made a big, you know, show of saying, look at, you know, what we've exited.
We had him on the channel last year. People would see if we had a very brief interview with him about it.
Yeah, and he's making the point that, look, this is the home of the EU and look how they're behaving, and that, you know, this didn't happen at the National Conference in London a year ago, but it does happen in other European countries, and he's quite right to point that out. And it, you know, the whole thing is extremely worrying for free speech, and it does make you wonder if lesser known individuals were putting on a conference and they didn't have the ability to defend themselves in the way that these quite high profile people can, and they can go to the media and they can talk about it, the likelihood it would be shut down and you probably wouldn't even hear about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So exactly. That's what's the most worrying and chilling thing about this, that even people with high status and power and money and influence are being shut down. So what does that mean for smaller groups?
Do you think, Rafe, it's part of this, what I sort of perceive to be, you know, a general kind of attack on conservative thought, or should I say expressions of it? You know, that generally, you know, the more, if you like, conspiratorial people amongst our friends would say, oh, well, actually, you know, the whole point is actually to generally outlaw eventually any kind of expression of conservative thought.
It's first and foremost the rise of authoritarianism. Yeah. These are the steps towards that sort of totalitarian state. And one of the reasons why we voted for Brexit was precisely because of this sort of thing. But you're absolutely right. This is about the suppression of the right and suppression of any opposing viewpoint to the prevailing orthodoxy that has gripped the EU, of which Brussels is its demagogic heart. And you just have to look at the scenes that we saw there to realize how the left are so gripped by fear and hysteria about the right that they create this complete bogeyman. You know, they have these ideas that, I don't know, what some cabal is meeting of far right neo-Nazi fascists, as if they were skinheads goose-stepping in the streets. You couldn't find a more placid and unaggressive group of people than the people who were attending that conference. You know, all people who are familiar to this channel, who've come to our own conferences, Matthew Goodwin, you know, Nigel Farage, you know, Suella Braverman, but all the people there are completely mainstream personalities. And what I loved about all of this was the judge's decision, which came in the early hours of the morning, where the judge very sensibly said, well, this threat to public safety doesn't come from the right. It comes from Antifa. It comes from the left. So why on earth are you suppressing the free speech of these people? The actual target should be these radical leftists who actually, we now understand, were potentially in cahoots with at least one of the three mayors, the three mayors who were involved here, who suppressed all of this. And this has backfired so extremely because, of course, as Amy was saying, they picked the wrong fight. If you're going to pick a fight, don't do it when you've got the national media of various countries involved, and don't do it when you have Nigel Farage literally on stage at the moment this is happening. We don't know how many times this has happened in the past, but this should make us alive and alert to the fact that, you know, there are very scary steps being taken in Europe now. You know, in Britain, you know, Remainers and young people think of the EU as being some land of liberty and liberalism. Well, the peoples of Poland and of Hungary and of Spain and of Greece, they know the EU for what it really is. And if you wanted to ask those people about ideas of liberalism in the EU, they'll have a very different opinion, one grounded on their own real experience of the EU. And this suppression of free speech, I think, should be a wake-up call to anyone who believes in liberty. And what's most interesting about this terribly sorry experience is the fact that there were no allies on the left in this country. The Labour Party absolutely disgrace themselves in their reaction. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I've seen time and again. You know, there was an occasion when Novara Media, which is a very radically left-wing YouTube channel, had one of their videos, or indeed their entire channel, cancelled. And there was uniform support for them from the right. Mm-hmm. We supported them, trigonometry, you know, everybody on the right was supporting Novara Media. And I can't imagine, you know, and it seems every time that free speech comes into play, the right are happy to defend the left on points of principle, but when the tables are turned, the support isn't there.
Yes, it is. They were utterly trivial, I thought, actually. They were sort of laughing and giggling, the Labour front bench, about it. I also saw an MP on GB News, I think it was, and he was trying to find these what he called unsavoury characters. Essentially, it's about, as you say, it's about things to do with abortion, gay marriage. I might not agree with what the people are saying, but these are views that are perfectly reasonable to have. Mm. I mean, at least certainly you shouldn't be banned from having them.
And it's a conference of various speakers, and I don't know, it looked like there's more than one people on the stage at some point, so there may well have been a debate, so there may have been pushback to certain ideas. You know, like you said, there's completely mainstream MPs. Miriam Cates was there, you know, and various other people. And as you said, it's I think it's appalling to see MPs like Wes Streeting laughing about this and just saying, oh, it's all far-right fanatics and ha-ha, the police are there. You just think, what? It's just unbelievable. There would be no, like you said, nobody on the right would laugh and think it was brilliant if a centre-left sort of conference was shut down. You'd have the Free Speech Union, which is led by Toby Young, who's a Conservative, intervening immediately. And it is just very, very concerning to seeing significant Labour MPs laughing about this and not flagging it up as a major issue.
Well, I mean, it's one of the ways in which the left works is that they don't accord us the same courtesy that we might accord them. They just don't. I remember a few years ago, and I can't remember the context, but the Socialist Workers' Party fell foul of some, I think it might have been YouTube or Twitter or one of these, right? And people on our side were actually, you know, supportive of them, said this should not happen, you know, this should not happen. Never get that from, we're never going to get that from them. Which bodes quite ill, does it not, for after the election? Mm-hmm.
Well, this is it. This is why I think we should all be very afraid of the future, because clearly there's no intrinsic belief in free speech on the left, in the Labour Party. You know, I mean, this is not news. People shouldn't be surprised about this sort of thing. But it's also the fact that now everybody is far right. You know, the window has shifted so far that anybody who was mainstream 10 years ago is now called far right. And the problem that happens when you do that is when the real far right rise up, no one's going to be taking any notice of it because everybody has been tarred with that same brush. And so we have diluted the meaning of what far right really means.
Well, we've also sort of more or less got rid of the expression right wing. I mean, that was always a kind of implicit insult anyway, but we now go, don't we, from centre to far right. Centre, far right.
Yeah, always used to be centre right, hard right, and then far right. Yes. That's how I always understood it. Yeah. Hard right's completely gone. And everything is now suddenly far right, whereas we can see the real fascists are actually the left.
Well, you see people like J.K. Rowling being called far right. It's absurd. You know, people that have voted Labour all their life being called far right.
Well, so. Also, the other thing as well, you know, when we talk about terrorism and extremism, people say, you've got Islamism here and then you've got the far right. You sort of think, have you looked at what these people think? It couldn't be more far right if you tried.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
it could not be more far right. I don't know why this isn't pointed out.
Well, this was the funny thing in Brussels, because the one of the mayors who had cancelled the NatCon conference in this venue had previously invited far right Turkish figures over. So again, you know, what's source for the goose clearly isn't source for the gander. Mm. But if you're not white, you can't possibly be far right, I suppose, is the left's
viewpoint.
No,
I think that's basically it. Speaking of authoritarianism, I can't quite get to grips with the actual way it's going to work. But apparently we are actually going to have a complete and utter smoking ban, aren't we? It was actually last night, we're recording this on a Wednesday. Last night, there was an overwhelming vote in favour of a smoking ban. In other words, younger people, after a certain year, 2009, I believe, If you were born after
that? That's right. So anybody who's born after 2009 will never become old enough to smoke. So the age at which you can buy a cigarette will increase steadily. When this legislation was first proposed, I looked at it and I thought, well, actually, this is very sensible, because nobody who smokes today will ever actually be stopped from smoking. If you're a smoker today, you'll smoke till the day you die. All this does, I thought at the time, all this does is it stops young people from starting to smoke, and no mother and no father would be happy if their child began to smoke. And we know that the vast majority of cigarette smokers today would like to quit and wish that they had never started. So on that level, I thought, oh, that's fine. However, the more I read about it and the more I've seen about it, the more insidious I've actually understood this to be, because it's actually creating a system whereby you're going to have adults of two different classes. You know, we could be born one day apart, and for your entire life you'll be able to buy stuff, which I won't be able to buy. But also, you could be a 55-year-old man and you'll sort of have to go into a shop and show your identification every time you want to buy something. And we've never had that sort of a system in our life, you know, everyone over 18 or whatever, but to have for the rest of your life always having to display that sort of thing, I think is very insidious as well. And also, of course, it's the thin end of the wedge, because what it says is that this is the first time we've had something which is not going to cause you immediate harm like poison. It's not going to make you, you know, antisocial like alcohol or drugs on the street. It's something that will cause long-term effects. But then, so what's to say that won't be applied to bad food, to fried food? Why won't that apply to alcohol in the future? Now look, I fully understand, you know, my mother died from lung cancer 2 years ago. I fully understand that, you know, smoking is the number one preventable cause of illness in this country. It costs billions. There does need to be something to be done about this. And I approve of the ban on vapes, because vapes are supposed to stop smokers from smoking, but now they're introducing as a gateway to young children. But I just think the whole thing needs to be reevaluated. And I should say, as a good old cigar smoker, what I'm most upset about personally is that premium quality tobacco is also included in this. And really? It's a very different thing. So cigars will now basically, cigars will be illegal in this country in about 40 or 50 years' time. And the great cigar shops of London and so forth will go out of business. And nobody has 40 cigars a day. A cigar you enjoy, you know, once in a while. I probably have two of these a week with friends, and it's a very convivial experience. It's not the same thing. Yes, of course, there's risk of mouth cancer and so forth, but it's an entirely different kettle of fish. And this is something that you come to late in life. Children don't start smoking cigars. They're far too expensive, for one thing.
What is that one, actually, Rolf?
That's a Partagas E2, which is my favorite smoke. That's about a sort of an hour thing, but it's a convivial experience. And to have such a premium quality tobacco, which is very different from a cigarette, banned, I just don't understand. Now, it's not going to affect me. I'll be able to smoke till the day I die, which probably will be sooner, thanks to these, than later. But, you know, but young people come to cigars in their 30s or 40s, and to think that that's gone, and it's the party of Winston Churchill, the man who made this into such an iconic symbol, that's doing this, and they're adopting a policy from the far left radical Jacinda Ardern from New Zealand. I mean, it's preposterous to call yourself the party of liberty and conservatism.
Apparently there are, I saw a list on social media of all the countries now where you can smoke indoors. So basically your home, which I think you can still do, sir. I mean, your home, cafes, restaurants, pubs, usual thing. And it's actually quite a long list. But it was distinctly un-Western. In fact, there is this view that the further east you go, the more people smoke. I mean, when you get to China, wow. I mean, virtually they're like beagles, you know. But I mean, I think, do you think, to me, this was like, when you think of the issues that we talk about every week on this program, and this is what they choose to make a big thing of.
I know. I think it's very much because, as Rafe said, this is sort of been borrowed from the Labour Party of New Zealand. And it may well be that Rishi's anticipating that the Labour Party will bring it in when they get into power. So it's just a kind of tactical move to make it a policy of the Conservatives, and they can claim it as their own policy, kind of prevent the Labour Party from championing it. I mean, the most of the people that voted this through last night were the Labour Party, and the people that voted against it, I think there was about 57 of them, were Conservative MPs, including Kemi Badenoch. So it is very much a Labour policy.
Yeah.
But it does seem odd that, you know, we're in the final dying days of the Conservative Party. By the end of the year, probably be that Rishi Sunak will be out and the Labour Party will be in. And it does seem odd that this is the policy that what he wants to be remembered for. It seems to lack any kind of ideology. It doesn't seem to represent anything. It was never brought in. It seems to be brought in very quickly. You didn't hear much talk of this policy over the last 12 years. So you just think, why are they suddenly doing this now? And it just shows that the Conservative Party, again, as we often say, sort of lacks an identity, and you don't really know what it's going to do from one week to the next, really. You just think this is kind of come out of nowhere. And, you know, we've all, as you say, all the serious issues that the Conservative Party are facing going into the next election, all the issues that we talk about here, that this would be the thing that they would want to get headlines for. It just seems very curious. What demographic are they speaking to? I don't know.
I would have thought, if any demographic, it might be young people, basically. I mean, Cameron, the only thing that Cameron's remembered for, apart from the fact that he gave that referendum, was gay marriage, wasn't it? And this guy, Sunak, it will be probably, as you say, smoking. I mean, the thing is every instinct of my fibre of my being goes against this, you know. I mean, the idea of banning. Because,
yeah.
I mean, basically, you know, you look around and you sort of think, you know, we've got a major obesity problem happening in this country, and yet I think the difference is that people are kind of, they're given sort of help, or they're not cast into hell. But I can tell you that if you are a smoker, there's nothing people cannot say about you. There is nothing, there is no rudeness they can't show you. I mean, you know, if I were a heroin addict, I smoke, right? I'm a heavy smoker. If I were a heroin addict or whatever, I'd get more sympathy. And there'd be a kind of glamour attaching to it as well, I suppose.
And there's already so many restrictions on smoking now. You know, you can't smoke in restaurants, you can't smoke in public transport, you can't smoke on the premises of in a workplace or in a hospital. Obviously, there's all messaging on cigarettes telling you it's bad for your health. So everything's there to kind of prevent this as much as possible already. And I do have kind of freedom, you know, in my bones. And I just think, I don't know that people should be prevented from smoking completely. I think there should still be the option to do it. It feels to me very draconian, actually. And the argument that's being used is it's going to save the NHS, that it puts a burden on the NHS. But as you say, obesity puts a far bigger burden on the NHS.
Literally.
As does alcoholism. And, you know, there's never been any sort of health promotional campaign to get people into gyms or to lose, you know, we don't hear about that anymore. Even in the
You do have the tax on sugar and all this, and the
is
stupid.
Is there actually a tax on sugar?
Yeah,
and taxes the poor. I mean,
and the stupid ban on advertising junk food on transport for London.
I think that, to me, there's never been a positive campaign. And as you say, we're actually moving, our society's moving into this kind of body positivity kind of culture, where you're not allowed to criticize anybody that might be overweight or suggest that they may want to change their lifestyle. So there's a real confusion about other health issues like alcoholism and obesity, where you're not even allowed to speak about it. And yet, I agree with cigarettes. It's kind of, I think for many people, it represents freedom. And that's the thing that's being, turned on, I think.
Yeah. But basically, there's a kind of joylessness facing this. That's my feeling about all of these things, you know. I mean, you know, if you say, oh, for goodness sake, you know, you're going to secondary smoking and all of that, though, you know, I don't think it's ever actually been proven. But anyway, it's just
the I think it had. I mean, that's how Roy Castle died and others.
It?
Yeah, because his life in the jazz clubs playing, no, he didn't smoke in his life. But yeah, no, but you're quite right. And it's, you know, I didn't support the smoking ban in venues. But I do think that we need to stop, you know, if people stop smoking altogether, cigarette, it will be a very good thing. I don't, you know, so I'm not somebody who actually thinks smoking is a good thing. I hope that no children would ever grow up to become smokers. My mother could have had a good 15, 20 years left in her life if she hadn't smoked. And I know that the majority of smokers in this country wish that they could give up and wish they had never started smoking. Mm. But at the same time, I don't want people's liberties to be crushed and to be eroded. And what's going to be next? You know, in 2014, Boris Johnson refused to ban smoking in parks and public spaces. I'm just surprised that Sadiq Khan hasn't yet banned it. Mm-hmm. But I believe me, he will when he gets the chance, because he's on this huge kick about clean air and everything else. New York, I think, has banned smoking in public spaces. Mm-hmm. Ottawa started this in Canada. And I wouldn't be surprised. And I think that's absolutely outrageous if you can't go for a walk on the street. Basically, you're being just ostracized from society.
Yeah, so Central Park, you can't, huge Central Park, you can't, you know, smoke in. And also, of course, they put all the prices up hugely. And in New York, prices are the same as here. I pay now, can you believe this, 17 quid for a pack of cigarettes. Gosh. When I started smoking, you could get them for 95p.
Wow.
But five shilling or something.
Ha, ha, ha. Yeah. No, 95p. But then mine were about 125, because I used to smoke these brand called Freeburg and Treia. They went out of business ages ago, but beautiful packs. Now, anyway, but I mean, the whole thing, you know, it's just, for me, it's just one little thing that is no longer going to be there in life. But anyway, one very good piece of news actually this week. We had a couple of good pieces of news lately, and it's letting the side down a bit, I think. Actually, but we had the CAS report, didn't we? Mm. But this week we had Catherine Burble saying, and essentially she has won her case against that Muslim pupil who wanted the ability to be able to pray. Isn't that right, Rafe? And she's won this case.
Yeah. So there was a Muslim pupil brought a legal case against the Makeda School. So the Makeda School is in the inner city London. It's a very, Catherine Burble saying is sort of well known as being a very strict headmistress, so it's a very conservatively run school, and it has a lot of high ethnic minority pupils, and I think at present it has about 50% Muslim pupils. Mm-hmm. But Catherine Burble does her best to promote British values and to make that the primary kind of identity of the school. And the legal case that was brought against the school was by a female Muslim pupil who wanted a prayer room. So the school was allowing people to sort of pray in the playground, but this pupil wanted a separate room to be able to pray, and she claimed it was discrimination that they didn't have a prayer room. Well, Catherine Burble-Singer's, her argument is essentially that it's a secular school. Everybody that goes to it knows that it's a secular school. It's also quite a small school. It's quite kind of underfunded. And there wasn't a room for a prayer room. It would have cost money, and it would have been impossible to facilitate, because if 50% of the school are Muslim, in order to provide a prayer room for all of them, essentially you'd have to have a mosque alongside the school, and it was a secular school. It wasn't a religious organisation. But that this young person brought a discrimination claim against the school and lost the claim yesterday, we found out. So that was good news. I mean, in some ways it's good news, but in other ways you think, well, the claim should never have been brought anyway. Mm. It was brought because the young person and their family was given legal aid of over hundreds of thousands of pounds, despite the fact that legal aid should be for the poorest people facing the most difficult kind of criminal incidents or events. And actually this was quite a sort of insignificant case, really. She could go to a different school, for example. She didn't have to go to the school. She knew that there wasn't a prayer room when she started at the school, so it felt much more like lawfare rather than somebody who'd actually suffered a serious kind of crime or been the victim of a crime. And yet she was given hundreds of thousands of pounds to bring this claim. But yeah, of course it's a victory, but it's a small victory, because in a sense it shouldn't really happened in the first place.
It sounds to me, you know, on the part of this girl bringing the case, a bit like mission creep to me.
Well, it's part of a much larger agenda of the left against the Makeda School in particular, because the Makeda School is one of perhaps the best performing school in the entire country. And it completely turns on its head this idea that poor children who had disadvantaged lives somehow they need to be accommodated, they have to be regarded as victims. And this completely turns on its head everything that the left says about the way you should treat people from disadvantaged communities. Because in the Michaela School, whatever your background, whatever your advantages or disadvantages, you are treated equally and you have the same expectations to excel on you, to study hard and do your best without any accommodation or those sorts of things. And it's working. And the left hate that because it completely destroys all of this victimhood culture. Also, what Michaela shows to the world is that you can have a successful, cohesive, multiracial as opposed to multicultural society, because culture is banned from the place. There's no identity politics. It is a school where everyone has to adhere to the one overarching identity, which is the British identity. And you have the singing of God Save the King and the flag, and the emphasis is on what unites us, not what on divides us. So it's actually a model, I would say, given the rates of immigration we have in this country, it's a model of what could be achieved in schools across the country where you see Hindus and Muslims sitting together having meals. And yet, of course, all of this flies in the face of the identity politics that the left want. The other thing, the final thing I'll say on this is a very important ruling because it says the headmistress is the final arbiter of what happens in a school. Mm. And there are a few venues, apart from perhaps the military, where it's more important than for a headmaster or headmistress to be the dictator of a school, because you can't have a situation where a child can just say, oh yeah, wait till my parents get their lawyers on you. Completely erodes all of the authority and discipline which children at that age needs, and this is the court reinforcing that.
The thing is, though, I mean, great news, and Catherine's been on this channel a number of times, remarkable when you think of the pressure she must have been under. The only thing that worries me is when you say that it is a model, it shows what can be done with a multi-ethnic society. In a way, it hasn't worked, therefore, has it? I mean, this woman, this girl took her to...
But that's one woman. No, it has worked, because this is a school that is... This shows how well it's worked, because this is a school that went from having 30% Muslim population, it increased to 50% because the parents were happy and willing for their children to go to that school, mm-hmm. knowing precisely what it was like, and even after prayer was banned, and when parents want to put their kids into that school, they have two meetings, I think, where they are told this is secular, there are no prayer rooms, they are told all of this. Of course, you're always going to get a bad egg somewhere. This happened to be some sort of nutcase woman, I suppose. But the majority of them, the fact that no one else has done that when half the school is Muslim, I think speaks to its success.
Yes. You know, I mean, I don't mean to labour the point, but it just seems to me that you do need just the one or the two to press it. And hasn't this happened before? Not in a school situation.
But now we have the ruling there. That's the point. Yeah. So we now do have the ruling. No, I think this is actually something very positive.
So therefore, you do need head teachers who are going to be resolute, don't you?
So every school in the country now knows that they do not need to make accommodation for cultural or religious practices and beliefs. Now, many schools do have prayer rooms, but there's no legal requirement for that. That's the takeaway.
Right. 150,000 apparently it cost.
Yeah, and apparently this young person might be appealing this decision, so it may well cost more.
Well, yeah, according to the report I saw, the family's already reapplied for other family members to join the school next year.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. Child they want to enter. It's so stupid.
Extraordinary, isn't it? Before we go, just a couple of quick words, highly appropriate given the general speed of her, you know, journey across the political firmament on Liz Truss. She's got a book out, hasn't she? What is it, 10 years in which to save the West? But apparently, according to the reviews anyway, some of which have been very good, actually, and others have been just the worst reviews ever. She mixes up how you might save the West with a general look at her, you know, what is it, 49 days in Downing Street, manages to drop the Queen in it as well, or rather, should I say, the late Queen, manages to basically talk about her final conversation with the Queen. You shouldn't really do should you in terms of taste and everything.
Well, this book was written very much with the American market in mind. That's why you have more references to, I think, Donald Trump than there are to, say, the OBR. And this is very much after she had her appearance at the CPAC, the American Conservative Conference. She's very much looking to fill her bank balance, I think, and that, and this book is very much part of that. But, you know, this woman, I absolutely loathe her. I always have done. You know, the subtitle of this book, you know, is because 10 years to save the West, colon, from the only conservative in the room. Really? Are you trying to tell me, Liz Truss, you're the only conservative? This woman has always been a liberal Democrat. You know, for the woman who stood up in that conference calling for a republic to abolish the monarchy in the Lib Dem is the same woman who, when she was prime minister, wanted to increase immigration to this country to grow the economy, as if that has worked in the, over the past 20 years. No one who calls himself a conservative in 2022, 2023, could call for more immigration as a solution to Britain's ailments. The woman is as deluded as she is disingenuous. And the fact that she managed to hoodwink the Tory party membership into voting for her when she has a woman who's completely incompetent and devoid of any charisma, I think means that the Tory party should really rethink how they select their leaders in the future, because the system is clearly broken, that you've ended up with, you know, this woman, and also now Penny Morden, people are thinking of as a Tory leader, a woman who's as woke as they get, whose only claim to fame was being able to hold a sword during a coronation, and yet for some reason the Tory party membership thinks she's their saviour as well.
Apart from that, she's all right. So what's your
I think it's a very strange trajectory that she's on, that she's trying to almost appear to a populist American audience. I mean, I think even the title of her book is a bit, it's very commercial. I don't know why it's 10 years to save the West as opposed to 5 years or 20 years. It all seems very faultless. And she's talking a lot about, she's going on to a lot of podcasts. She seems to be doing the sort of podcast media circuit at the moment. She's been on Talk TV, she's been on Spectator, and she's talking a lot about how in this very short space of time that she was Prime Minister, she's gained a hell of a lot of insights about how difficult it is to implement policies. So she's talking a lot about kind of the blob and the deep state and kind of bureaucracy and the civil service. And she is kind of using that language that, you know, Americans use, like the deep state, which, I mean, she's some sort of valid points about policies not being able to get through. Obviously, the Rwanda policy is a good example of that. Although I'd find that her 49 days as Prime Minister probably isn't enough to sort of speak from experience about that. But I mean, it seems very odd, and it seems very like she is doing it for her own gain. And I don't know what she wants to do going forward in terms of if she wants to come back into British politics. And I mean, obviously I haven't read the book, but I don't know what she is providing as a solution to this kind of idea of the deep state. She's naming the problem, but it's a problem that we've named on this show, and people have been naming for years now. And it seems because suddenly she is now rallying against the bureaucratic deep state. And you do think, well, some of us have been saying this for a long time. It's not a new head, you know, it's not news.
That's precisely the point. She's so late to the party, you know. And just to call yourself the only conservative in the room, I mean, Suella Braverman was late to the party as well, but she was earlier than Liz Truss was on this, you know. And Liz Truss never takes responsibility for anything that happened. If you read this book, everything is somebody else's fault. Now, you know, some things I'm sure were right, you know, she didn't. So, and she's correct about attacking the deep state. She's correct, for example, about how Tony Blair has created a system whereby, you know, government, the judges and the courts have far more power than before, and that is hampering and restricting the ability of elected people to do what they want to do. But what she's a pure opportunist. She's only discovered small c conservatism, because let's remember, when she is a neoliberal free market extremist, she doesn't believe in society or in communities. True conservatives want to conserve societies, from the working classes all through the society. She's never been part of that until now. Why? Because she suddenly realized, you know, she's read Matt Goodwin, she's seen what Suella Braverman's doing, and she thinks, I'll be part of this. And she's just trying to essentially ride the coattails of all of this, thinking she can become some sort of champion of conservatism. I'm sorry, but she's a snake oil salesman.
Yes. This thing that she started, along with Mark Littlewood, called PopCons. Sounds like Pop-Tarts, doesn't it?
Or popcorn.
Yeah, popcorn. popular conservatism. Which is basically has had a launch and that's it. It's gone nowhere. Really.
But it's needless because they already have the new Conservatives, which really are small seed, decent folk, Danny Kruger, Miriam Cates. Those people understand the issues at play. This popcorn, and why the fact that she couldn't join them, but she had to have her own show called Popcorn, tells you all that this is all that she's about.
The thing is with I don't know if you find, the thing with Liz Truss, all of this I'd agree with, you know, but the thing is what the overpowering thing for me was that she was so obviously not up to it. I mean that you there would be this and it right up to now. I saw her actually Nigel interviewing her on the on GB News and she's been on a few other things, Fox, you know, where she held the book up the wrong way and everything. But you know, you kind of look at her and you sort of think, how have you got this far? There's no finesse there. There's this kind of brittle quality. You know, when someone's trying to judge whether you're being funny or not, you know, there's a certain look on their face. And that basically is what she has all the time. You know, and that, you know,
I find her quite difficult to read. She's talking about these issues, but she often talks about them in quite an unserious way. She's kind of giggles sometimes. You don't feel that she's got, you know, you do. She does, and you sort of think, you know, she's so, almost a bit flirtatious. She's a bit, she's just very odd, and you just think, you know, do you really take these issues seriously, or is this just some kind of PR stunt? And I find it hard to place her. You know, when you see people like Suella Braverman when she talks about issues, you do feel like she means it. But with Liz Truss, it does just feel very opportunistic, and she doesn't talk with the seriousness and the professionalism that you would expect to be talking about these issues.
Well, remember, she spent her entire time as Foreign Secretary doing permanent photo shoots, these embarrassing photographs with, you know, chin on hand and in a tank like Margaret Thatcher, even wearing the same outfits as Margaret Thatcher. All done to try to convince the Tory party membership that she was, you know, Thatcher reborn. And I'm sorry, the same thing Penny Mordaunt's doing, just the same thing. And the Tory party membership were falling for this. And, you know, this is what I'm talking about. The fact that a woman of such limited ability, who, as you say, is devoid of charisma. Do you remember that Tory conference when she was talking about cheese? As if, I mean, it's cringeworthy. And it's hugely embarrassing for us that we had this person representing us on the world stage, albeit briefly.
There is one funny thing, actually, final point. You know, you talk about Penny Mordaunt carrying a sword at the coronation and everything. Apparently, it's extraordinary how life works, isn't it? I think it was Liz Truss gave Penny Mordaunt that role. You know, which is, what was the role that she had, Penny Mordaunt? What is the actual ceremonial role that she had?
Sword bearer or something.
No, it's something like Lord
Chamberlain. Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
Something like that. And basically, to shunt her to one side. And look, sure enough, what happens is that fate took a hand in it. The late Queen died. Penny Mordaunt ends up being right in the centre stage, probably the first and only time that will ever happen in our lifetimes. And so now everyone's talking about her as being a successor.
You know. I suspect Liz Truss is quite jealous that she didn't get to
carry the sword. Because she was out of her depth during that whole period. You remember when there was succession council and everything, and she kind of looked like she looked like an understudy, basically, which is what she is. Anyway, so that's Liz. Okay, thank you very, very much indeed. Amy, thanks, Ray, for it once again. And we shall see you next time. In the meantime, have a good week and keep your eye open as well on the channel for all the various things that are coming from our national conference, because we're going to be putting them up on the channel over the next few weeks. Okay, take care, bye. Hello, if you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.